We're in week four of our series called Church Essentials, and we've been based in John chapter 17, which is called Jesus' high priestly prayer, and it's a prayer that Jesus prays for his church. He prays for his disciples that are with him, and then for those that will come after them because of what they believe, who will believe after them because of what they teach them, which is us, the church. And he says, Jesus says, these are some of the things that I want my church to be known for, some of the things that I want to mark my church. And there's 10 things that he mentions, and we've gone through three of them, and today we go through a fourth. And so we went through unity and mission and truth, and today we're looking at holiness. And the beautiful thing about these four characteristics, these four character traits or habits that the church needs to be known for, these four have to exist together. They can't exist by themselves. And when Jesus puts these 10 things down, he says, these are the things I want my church to be known by. It's not a list of, okay, we'll choose 3, 4, and 7, and the rest of you can do something else. I can't just say, I want to take these three, these are my favorite three, and I'll leave that one because it's not really my favorite, so I won't do that one. Because they are dependent on one another. There's not one that's more important than the other. So we can't say we are a truth church. We can't say we are a holiness church. We are a mission church. No. If we want to be a Jesus church, we have to be all of those things. Because if we're not a Jesus church, then to be very honest, I love you all, but I've got better things to do if this is not a Jesus church. Our desire, our goal, is to be a Jesus church. And so I can't have unity and holiness without mission. And I can't have mission without truth and unity. Holiness depends on, is built on the truth. And it's for the sake of mission. All of these four things depend on each other in order for them to be present. So let's speak about holiness. When I say the word holiness, or if I speak of holy people, who do you picture, or what do you picture? For some people, it might be, a monk in a monastery on top of a very small building, on top of a very tall mountain. For others, it might be a man dressed in white, living a very simple life. Perhaps you picture somebody like Mother Teresa or Billy Graham, perhaps even Nelson Mandela, if I speak about somebody that is holy. Some people, perhaps the holiest person that you can think of is a person sitting in the clouds or in heaven somewhere, because in some people's minds, the holier we get, the less earthly we get. So if the holiest people are not of the earth, then how come does Jesus pray that we would be holy and also that we would not be taken out of the earth? If that's the case, that Jesus is tricking us, which is not the case. So it seems from Jesus' prayer that we're going to get into in a minute that the more holy we are, actually the better we are for the earth. It's not the more holy I become, the more time I spend in heaven, and my mind is in heaven and my heart's in heaven and actually the less time I spend on earth. Now Jesus says, it seems to be, actually the holier I become, the better I am for the earth. Actually the more earthly I become. Not of the earth, but I become better for the earth. So he says this in John chapter 17, from verse 14. It says, Jesus talking to the Father. He says, I gave them, us, your word. The godless world hated them because of it, because they didn't join the world's ways, just as I didn't join the world's ways. I'm not asking you to take them out of the world, but that you guard them from the evil one. They are no more defined by the world than I am defined by the world. He says, make them holy, consecrated. We'll get to that word in a minute. With the truth. Your word is consecrating truth. In the same way that you gave me a mission in the world, I give them a mission in the world. I'm consecrating myself for their sakes so that they will be truth consecrated in their mission. So Jesus prays that we would be kept from evil, but also that we would be kept in righteousness, in holiness. It's two emphases. And he uses a word here, consecration. And the word consecration has two implications. It's to be separate from something, but for the purpose of being in something. To be separated from something into something else. And I think too many people think of holiness as I am separate from sin. If I sin less, then I am holy. The less I sin, the more holy I become. But Jesus seems to suggest, I sin less, but I've also got to do the right thing. I'm separated from something for the purposes of being separated into something else. And he uses the word holiness, and it's got similar implications. Holiness is not only not doing the wrong thing, holiness is also doing the right thing. And so I can't say I sin less and I do the wrong thing less, therefore I am becoming more holy. No, that's partly true. It's true that if I do less of the wrong thing, I'm more holy. But it's more true that if I do more of the right thing in the right way, that I have a fuller holiness. Consecration and holiness are not just a negative attribute. They're not just freedom from something. They're freedom into something. They are a positive attribute. It requires something of me. Not just to be taken away from that, to turn my eye from that, to turn my ear from that, but to turn my eye to this. To turn my ear to this. From you to my wife. I'm joking. My wife's the son. So it's separate from sin for goodness. Not doing the wrong thing, but also doing the right thing, the right way. Start off by saying this is actually a really difficult message to bring. See, the more I understand the holiness of God, the more my own unholiness is exposed. That's why holiness has to exist with unity. See, I can go and sit in a cave somewhere, and I can be away from people with no internet and not much else to do, and it's a lot easier in that place to think of myself as a little bit more holy than I am, until I come and spend time with people. And then I realize, oh, there's actually quite a lot going in my heart, quite a lot going in my mind that is unholy. When I'm removed from people, it's easy to think of myself as holy, but holiness has to exist with unity. So if I don't have a unity component to my holiness, I have an empty holiness. Actually, we call that self-righteousness. Holiness, aside from unity, is self-righteousness. I think of myself more highly than I am because I'm not with people who have exposed the unholiness that still exists in my heart. Ouch. See, true holiness separates me from sin, but it also gives me godly character. And the only way that I can have godly character is if I'm with people who can expose what my true character actually is. Those of you who have kids will know that that's true. Kids expose what our true character is. See, without unity and mission, I might as well die and go and live in heaven, because then I'll be holy and I don't need unity and mission. Unity and mission are earthly requirements for holiness. When I'm in heaven, I don't need them. And so if I want to have holiness apart from unity and mission, I might as well die and go to heaven. Then I'll be holy. But if I'm on earth, whilst I am on earth, I need to have truth with unity, with mission, and with the other one, holiness. See, the more I know and understand the holiness of God, the more I'm aware of my own inadequacies. That's what makes this a difficult message to preach, because I'm painfully unaware that I don't meet all of Christ's requirements and standards. A man called Andrew Murray writes a book about humility, and he calls it The Beauty of Holiness. I love that title. Humility is the beauty of holiness. He says that it's actually not sin that humbles us, it's grace. Grace humbles us more than sin ever could. See, the more I see and the more I know holiness, the more I understand my complete reliance in the grace of God, because the more I see it, what it actually is, the more I realize I don't match up to it, and I actually never will. And so the more I see it, the more I know I need God's grace, and so therefore the more humble I am, because I'm not reliant on my own self, I'm fully reliant on the grace of Jesus Christ. So the holier I become, the more humble I should be becoming. And we said last week, we spoke on truth, and we said that when we have an issue with mission, if our lives are missionless, when we scratch a little bit deeper, what's actually the issue is that there's a problem with truth. We have a problem with truth. And so when we don't have an issue with truth, the fruit of that will be that we live missionless lives. When we have a problem with holiness, the fruit of that is that we will live proud lives. We will live self-sufficient lives. Humility is a fruit. Humility is the beauty of holiness. It is a byproduct of holiness. So if you think of yourself as holy, you can't think of yourself as humble. Somebody else has got to tell you that you're humble, because if you think of yourself as humble, you take pride in your humility, and you start again. That's how it works. Somebody else has got to tell you that you're humble. That's just for free. That's why Paul writes to the Roman church, and he says in Romans chapter 5, just as through the one man, Adam, all were made sinners, so also through the one man, Jesus, all are made righteous. I am fully dependent on the grace of God. When I understand what is the standard, when I understand what holiness is, I'm fully reliant on the one man, Jesus. We are fully reliant to make all of us righteous. I don't become holy, righteous, sanctified by anything that I do other than placing my trust in Jesus. The only thing that I contribute to my salvation is the sin that made it necessary. That's all I contribute, the sin that made it necessary. And so I can try and remove myself far, I can remove myself far away from sin. I can go and live in a cave and I can wear a blindfold so that I never sin by what I see. And I can disconnect from the internet so I never sin by what I'm looking at. I can wear earmuffs with white noise so I never sin by what I'm hearing. I can take a vow of silence so that I never sin by what I'm saying. I can become an organic farmer and eat really simple and so that I never sin by what I'm eating. And at the end of the day, if I do all of that, I will only be slightly more holy and still falling far short of the standard of requirement of holiness. That's not what holiness is. It's not separation from sin only. It is doing the right thing the right way. I can't measure holiness by my standard. I've got to measure holiness by God's standard. If I measure it by my standard, that means I measure myself against you. And sometimes I look really good. And sometimes I look really bad. It just depends who I choose to compare myself with. We call that self-righteousness when people measure the standard of holiness by themselves. That's not only a super unattractive quality, but it's an error. The standard for holiness is God's standard, and God's standard for holiness is perfection. That's God's standard, perfection. Doesn't matter how good you think you are, or in actual fact, how good you are not perfect. We've got a couple of small kids, and when they were smaller, we've always encouraged them to have an imagination. And so we said to them, just imagine. You flying, they imagine flying. They imagine themselves in another country. They can swim. They can breathe underwater. They are motorbikes. They are different animals. They play a cops and robbers. Imagination. That's how they can imagine anything that they can do to have fun. But the one thing that they never do is pretend to be perfect. It's more believable for them that they've got scope in their imagination to believe that they can fly before they can believe that they can be perfect. It's beyond us. If that is the standard, if that is God's standard for holiness, perfection, it is beyond us. We are unable to achieve it or attain it. See, the more I understand it and the more I know it, of God's standard of holiness, the more I realize that I don't come close to measuring up and I'm fully reliant on the grace of Jesus Christ. That's why grace humbles me far more than sin does, because I'm reliant on it. And so the more holy I become, the more humble I should become. Paul writes a letter to the church that meets in Corinth, and he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 that he describes a set of behaviors, and he says, when you behave this way, you are actually behaving like ordinary men. That word ordinary is not a good ordinary. You know, like when your wife comes home, or you come home and your wife says, how was your day? And I say, it's ordinary. It's not a good ordinary, right? The Proteas were ordinary. It's not a good ordinary. Paul says, when you behave this way, you are ordinary men. You're behaving like ordinary men. One of the other translations says, mere men, mere mortals. You're behaving as if this earth is all you have. You're just men. See, when we understand the saving work of Jesus and what it does for us, not only do we begin to avoid sin more, and so we sin less, but we also start to act a little bit more like Jesus every day. We start to act less like ordinary men and more like heavenly men, more like extraordinary men when I understand the saving work of Jesus. Grace humbles me far more than sin ever could. This is a process of sanctification, of every area of my life becoming more like Jesus and less like me, more representative of the kingdom of heaven and less representative of the kingdom of the earth. Paul writes another letter to the church in Galatians chapter 5, and he says in verse 20, it's obvious what kind of life develops out of trying to get your own way all the time. Then he lists a bunch of characteristics: repetitive, loveless, cheap sex, a stinking accumulation of mental and emotional garbage, frenzied and joyless grabs for happiness, trinket gods, magic show religion, paranoid loneliness, cutthroat competition, an all-consuming yet never satisfied want, a brutal temper, an impotence to love or be loved, divided homes, divided lives, small-minded and lopsided pursuits, the vicious habit of depersonalizing everyone into a rival, uncontrolled and uncontrollable addictions, ugly parodies of community. He says, this is not the first time I warned you. If you use your freedom this way, you will not inherit God's kingdom. He says, if you live as ordinary men, as mere humans, this is the sort of stuff that's produced in you. And so most people's reaction is when we list those characteristics, you think to yourself, oh yeah, I've seen that in other people. I've recognized some of those character traits in society out there. But actually what grace requires of us, what holiness requires of us is humility to begin to recognize them in some of them in ourselves. But if I only recognize them in other people, pride is a stumbling block, which means I lack holiness. He goes on to say that if you live by the Spirit, when you live a life of holiness by God's grace, he says he gives gifts into our lives the same way that fruit appears on a tree. Things like affection for others, exuberance about life, serenity. We develop a willingness to stick with things, a sense of compassion in the heart, and a conviction that a basic holiness permeates things and people. We find ourselves involved in loyal commitments, not needing to force our way in life, able to marshal and direct our energies wisely. Of those two sets of characteristics, which would you choose? Of course, the second one. Of course. See, a godly character, holiness in a person is attractive to everyone. Not only does holiness look good in you, but it's attractive to a broken, lost, sinful world. Friends, have you been exposed to a holy moment? Have you seen holiness in a person? I have. And it's compelling. There's something attractive and beautiful about it. Every time the church gathers, it is a holy moment. Some are aware of it, and some are not aware of it. That's okay. But have you been in a holy moment that you were aware of? Because if you have, you won't forget it. There is something that draws you into it. I think that's why Jesus prays that his church would be holy, because he understands the beauty of it. He understands the attraction of it. And so when his church is humble and she becomes holy, she becomes attractive and beautiful to the world. Have you been in a holy moment, friends? I have. I remember the privilege and the pain of being at a dear friend, Faisal's bedside as he passed away. And I picked up his wife, Rita, and took her to the hospital. And we sat in the hospital bed, and he was passing away of cancer, so it wasn't going quietly. It was machines and oxygen, and it wasn't a quiet death. It was a traumatic, painful situation. And as he sat there struggling to breathe and all these machines were going, and Auntie Rita prayed for him, and she said, Jesus, thank you that you've given me this man as a husband. And I release him to you now. And I watched as she said those words. I saw his heart rate monitor just begin to drop. And as it got right down to the bottom, I saw a look in his face. There was a moment when he realized that this world had lost its grip on him. I think he saw what was coming. It was a moment of holiness. It was a moment of purity in the midst of pain and suffering was the moment of purity in his face. Friends, if you've seen godly character, if you've seen holiness in a person's face, you won't forget it. It is compelling. We had the privilege a couple of months ago of seeing it in another man's face, a man called Jeremy who was on guitar this morning. He was baptized by his wife a few months ago, and as he came out of the water, there was something different in his face. There was something different in his eyes. There was a light that wasn't there previously. There was a freedom. There was a holiness in his face. If you've seen it, it will draw you in. There was peace. There was joy. There was purity. I had the privilege of sitting with a young man who had worked through pornography addiction. And just before he got married, I had the privilege of listening to him as he spoke about purity. As we looked into his face, what was written on his forehead, what was evident in his eyes, was purity, was holiness. Friends, if you have seen it, it is an attractive quality. It's something that I want. It is attractive to a world that is broken and sinful, a world that needs holiness. It's captivating to see holiness on a person. It's not just captivating to Christians. It's not just captivating to rich people or poor people or black people or white people or men or women. It's captivating to everyone. It's not to the old or the young. It's not to different cultures, to different races, to different genders. It is attractive to everyone. That character, it crosses. That character, godliness, the godly character of holiness, it crosses all of those boundaries, and it is attractive universally to every single person, every single people group. It compels them. It draws them, which is why Jesus prays, "Would my church be holy? Would the world be captivated with my beauty because the church reflects my holiness?" See, when we don't understand holiness, our tendency is to think of ourselves as a little bit less sinful than we actually are. We think to ourselves, here's my standard, and I live according to that standard, and my standard's pretty good, and I live according to it. When we don't understand holiness. See, no matter what we call it, sin is still sin. We can't change the name of something and then just because we no longer call it sin, suddenly I don't sin anymore. So I was doing this, which was sinful. And so what I'll do is I'll change the name of this so that it's no longer, we'll call it something else. Therefore, I sin less because I'm not doing what is sin. Doesn't matter what we call it. Sin is still sin. A couple of weeks ago, there was an issue in a mine in Rustenburg, and there was a little bit of confusion what was going on. The bottom line is there was 200 miners underground that weren't coming out for whatever reason. And so they interviewed the head of the labor union. They said, "Please, tell us what is going on with these 200 miners underground. They've been there for like 2-3 days. What's happening?" So the interviewer said, "Thank you for having me. I want you to know that what's taking place is an involuntary sit-in." I sat there and I listened. I thought to myself, an involuntary sit-in? Do you mean a hostage situation? What is an involuntary sit-in? He said, it doesn't matter what you call it. You can change the name of it. You can call it something else. It's still that. I can change the name of sin and call it an expression of sin. It doesn't matter what I call it. I can take a pig and put clothes and lipstick on it, and tomorrow morning it's still going to wallow in the mud and eat slop. Sin is still sin, no matter what I call it. See, the wages of sin is still death, the Bible tells us. At the end of a long day, working hard for our master, sin, when we get home with our wage packets and we open it, all it contains is death. Huh? That wasn't what I was looking for. I was hoping for a bit more. No, it's death. Sin will always require from us more than we're able to pay. So if I take a loan from the bank will require something from me as a collateral. And so I want to borrow 100 rand from the bank. I say to the bank, take my Proteas cricket shirt as collateral for 100 rand. And the bank says, it's not worth 100 rand. Proteas are taking a bit of a hammering today. No, actually, they took a hammering a few days ago. So I want to borrow 100 rand from the bank, which means I've got to give them something. They've got to hold something of mine that's worth the equal amount of what I want to borrow, and they hold that as collateral so that if I'm unable to pay that loan back, they then take possession of, they own what I've given them as a collateral. You with me? So sin requires life as a collateral. Sin requires a life as a collateral. You've got to hold your life as a collateral. And if sin costs me more than I'm able to pay, I have to give my life, which is why the wages of sin is death. Because I'm unable to pay the debt that I owe to sin, I can't settle it, and so it takes the collateral, which is a life. The beauty of what Jesus does is he says, I know that you can't pay it. I'm going to give my life. I will stand as a collateral. I will pay that debt that you cannot pay on your own. And so, John, when the day comes that the debt becomes payable and you're unable to pay it, what I'll do is I'll give my life instead of yours, and in replace of that, I'll give you life for free. Free life, a fullness of life when you cannot pay the debt. So not only am I free from debt, I suddenly have a life that I never had to start with. I'm not only free from sin to stop doing that, I'm free to begin to do this, to begin to actually live. I'm not only free from death, I'm free into life. That's the gospel. Not only free from death, free into life. You should be a lot more excited at that. That is the good news of the gospel. So that when Jesus has an interaction with the woman caught in sin, caught in adultery, he says two things to her. He restores her gently. He says, nobody condemns you, and therefore neither do I. Your sins are forgiven. And then he says these incredible words, now go and sin no more. Have you thought about how incredible those words are? Now go and sin no more. He says, your sins are forgiven. Now go and sin no more. So either it's possible for us to go and sin no more, either it's possible for us to be more holy in what we do, or Jesus is playing a horrible trick on this woman. I think the reason that he tells her these words and he gives them to us is so that we understand what is on the table, what Jesus' offer is. Jesus' offer is not only your sins are forgiven, his offer is sin no more. It's not only you are free, you owe death nothing, yes, but you also have life. Don't only not die, live. Fullness of life. He wants us to understand this is what's on the table, friends, for you and for me. One of the Greek words for sin in the New Testament is the word hamartia. It means to miss the mark. You might have heard Rich speak on this before, to miss the mark. And so if you think of a person throwing darts at a dartboard, if the bullseye is holiness, I miss the mark. I miss the holiness. Every time I miss it. So holiness is not only about hitting it once, it's about hitting it every single time I throw. And I don't only throw every 6 months, I throw every second of every day. I'm throwing, throwing, throwing. And if I want to be holy, it means that I throw bullseye, bullseye, bullseye. I don't miss it, because as soon as I miss the mark, I am a mark misser. If I miss it once, and as Vin Diesel taught us, it doesn't matter if you miss it by a millimeter or if you miss the board completely, you still miss the mark. So if I am a mark misser, I am a sinner. I missed the mark. That is what sin is. It means I need somebody to hit the mark for me. Again, the good news of the gospel. But so not only does Jesus enable me to hit the mark once, if all he did was enable me to hit the mark once, it would be enough for me to get into heaven for eternity with a holy God. But he doesn't only do that. He enables me to, if that was the case, I would just go to heaven. But he leaves me on earth to keep throwing darts and to start hitting that mark more often. It's not only freedom from this, it's freedom for this. The good news of the gospel. That's why when Jesus prays in John 17, he says, don't take them out of this world. But he also prays, he also says, they are not of this world. If all Jesus had ever done was to hit that mark once, that would be enough for eternity. But he enables me to keep doing it. He keeps me in the world. To keep hitting the mark of holiness more often, because that holiness is attractive to a broken, sinful world that is constantly missing the mark. So the world is constantly missing the mark. And so when I'm more often hitting the mark, it is attractive. It's an attractive quality. So sin is not only doing the wrong thing, it's also not doing the right thing. We talk about sins of omission and sins of commission. A sin of commission is something that I do, something that is wrong that I do. I've committed a sin. A sin of omission is something that I omit to do. I don't do it. So not doing the right thing is equally sinful to doing the wrong thing. So we like to think of ourselves, I don't do those things, therefore I'm more holy. He says, no, it's not only not doing the wrong thing. If you don't do the right thing, it is equally sinful. Which is the reason that holiness is not only not doing the wrong thing, it's doing the right thing. It is the counter to that. It's both. It's omission and commission. Things that I do and things that I don't do. Not of the world, but also not out of the world. See, there's no such thing as neutrality when it comes to sin. Not doing the right thing is not neutral. It's sin. So we are in the world, but separate of it. We are not of the world, but also not out of the world. That means if we are to be holy in the world, we have to be different. We spoke about ordinary men. We spoke about extraordinary men, mere men. We can't be ordinary humans. We have to be separate, different, separate from sin, separate for holiness. We have to be separate from the thinking, the talking, the actions of the world. Friends, if Jesus has left us in this world to be holy, we have to be separate from the sin and separate for the holiness. I cannot look the same, think the same, speak the same, drink the same things in the same amount, smoke the same things, look at the same things, listen to the same things that the world listens to. If I'm constantly throwing at the dartboard and hitting the dog, that is not attractive. The world is not coming to me and saying, will you teach me how to hit the mark? Because I'm not hitting the mark. If I'm in the world and not separate from it, it is not attractive. And so many Christians live unattractive lives, uncompelling lives. When people look at your life, are they compelled by the beauty of holiness, by what they could be living? Or do they just see people missing, missing, missing? Uncompelling. The church lacks holiness. You know one of the sorest things to do, if you've ever played a ball sport with a bat, one of the sorest things that you can do is to get your finger caught between the bat and the ball. You know that little sound that you make? It's a little squeal. You're muting something. It is painful. Finger, bat, ball, finger in the middle. It's sore. See, but the church sits on that interface. Jesus leaves us, the church, here on earth, as a finger that sits between the bat of holiness and the ball of the world. Not of the world, but also not out of the world. The church sits in the interface where holiness and sin collide, where the kingdom of darkness and the kingdom of light collide. And in the middle, between the bat and the ball, sits the finger, the church. And it is painful. That finger is a painful place to be. But we've got to remind ourselves, Jesus hasn't left us there by accident. Jesus didn't go to heaven and think, I forgot the kids again. I left them on earth. Oh, sorry, Dad. Can you go and get them when you're going on a round trip to the shop? He didn't leave us there. He hasn't left us on earth on accident. He's left us here on purpose. He says, I've left you as the finger between the bat and the ball, as the church where the kingdom of darkness collides with the kingdom of life, in that painful spot so that you can be holy and attract those in the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. We've got to remind ourselves, because it's a painful place to live, we've got to remind ourselves that there is a reason for it when it hurts. Jesus knows that the beautiful quality of holiness, of godly character, of differentness, of otherworldliness is attractive to a world that is broken and missing the mark. So as usual, let's close with three things relating to holiness. We have to be holy, number one, in our thinking. Holiness in our thinking is knowing the right thing. This is where it starts. Before you can do the right thing, you have to know what the right thing to do is. Let's go back to our sin and darts analogy. Our small children never played darts, but they did throw a lot of darts at the dartboard. The reason I say that they never played darts is because they didn't know what the game of darts was. They didn't know what the purpose was. They didn't know what the rules were. They didn't know what the technique was. They didn't know what the strategy was. They did not play the game of darts, but yet they threw a lot of darts at the dartboard. They didn't know what the right thing to do was. I think so many people go living their lives not understanding what the right thing to do is. So we think, no, we're playing the game, but we have nothing to hit. We have nothing to aim for. We're breaking rules that we don't even know exist because we don't know what the right thing to do is. This process of holiness, of us becoming more like Jesus, begins with knowing what the right thing to do is. This is why holiness works with mission, because it's the mission of those who are being made holy to attract the moths of this world to the light of holiness. As you live holy lives, as people are attracted to the holiness in the church, so then it is our job to teach them what the right thing is. When Jesus gives final instructions to his disciples before he goes back to heaven, one of the things that he tells them is, teach them to obey everything I've commanded you. He says, teach them, in other words, what the right thing is. Teach them what the right thing is. Friends, how will people know what the right thing is unless somebody tells them? How will anybody know what the right thing is unless somebody tells them? And who will tell them if not us? Who will tell them if not us? Secondly, We have to be holy in our actions. Holiness in our actions is doing the right thing. Knowing the right thing counts for absolutely nothing if I don't do the right thing. Remember, being holy is not only not doing wrong things, it's doing the right thing. It's separate from sin for goodness. Knowing the right thing has to lead me to doing the right thing. Statistically, the average Christian's knowledge is 3 years ahead of their practice, which means that on average, we are 3 years worth of knowing the right thing ahead of doing the right thing. We are 3 years ahead of knowing the right thing ahead of doing the right thing. Friends, that's a problem. For people in the world, for those that are new to the faith, knowing the right thing is the issue. They need holiness in their thinking, which is why the scriptures instruct us to renew our minds, to renew our way of thinking, so we can know what the right thing to do is. We need holiness in our thinking. Those that are new to the faith, that are new to Christ, we often want to get them to do the right thing without them ever knowing what the right thing to do is. And so we want to correct behavior before we've corrected minds. Now teach them what the right thing to do is. Those that have been following Jesus for a while, our problem is not knowing the right thing. We know too much of the right thing. Those that have been following Jesus for a while, our problem is doing the right thing. It's no good. Knowing the right thing counts for zero unless you do the right thing. When I was in matric, I went to visit a friend who'd been living in Cape Town for about a year. I was there for 3 weeks, and after 3 weeks, one of his friends came to me and said, "John, how come you don't swear?" And so I said, "It's easy. The Proteas aren't playing a World Cup semi-final. It's easy not to swear." And he said to me, "I've noticed that Grant also doesn't swear. My friend had been living for a year as a finger between the bat and ball. He'd been living as holy between the kingdom of darkness and the kingdom of life for a year in that painful position. And after a year, I went down and this other guy came to me and said, 'I've noticed there's something different about your friend. You don't swear.' And actually, now that I've noticed that, I've realized that what was attractive about him is that there was a holiness to him also. He was doing the right thing. Knowing the right thing to do counts for nothing unless you do the right thing." Our holiness doesn't stop there, though. We have to be holy in our motives, which means we want to know, we want to do the right thing. Holiness in our motives is us wanting to do the right thing. As we do the right thing, a funny thing begins to happen. We start to want to do the right thing. We call this a change of desire. Those of you that have ever begun a diet or an exercise and stuck with it will know when this thing takes place. You start off hating it. And after a while, the more you do it, you see the benefits of it, and you suddenly wake up. There's a morning that you wake up, and you're like, "I want to do it. I desire the kale. I desire that hard exercise because I know the benefit of it. My body wants it." So the more I begin to do it, the more what actually happens over time, it becomes a habit, and then I want to do it. But this, the beautiful thing about these three qualities is they're not a linear instruction. It's not do one, then do two, then do three. It's not a line, it's a circle. And so the more that I do the right thing, the more I want to do the right thing. And so as my desire changes, the more I want to do the right thing, the more I want to know about the right thing. And the more I know, the more I do. And the more I do, the more I want it. And that cycle becomes a self-sustaining cycle and process of holiness. We call that sanctification, becoming like Jesus. And if that sounds too easy, and if it sounds too good to be true, first of all, it is. And secondly, I want to remind you about the analogy of the finger between the bat and the ball. The reason that process exists is because we live in a painful in-between. We live on the painful interface between darkness and light, between death and life. So Jesus says, "I left you there in a painful situation, but I've also left you a helper, the Holy Spirit, and I've left you a process. If you keep walking and talking with the helper, if you keep relying on him as you follow the process, you'll be able to live as a finger between the bat and ball. And not only that, people will come to know eternal life and freedom in me because of you." And friends, there's no greater privilege, no greater joy than that. Holiness, the process of becoming godly in our character, is not only for people who live in heaven. It's not for monks and monasteries. It's not for gurus on top of mountains. It is available and on offer for for me and you. And if we trust Jesus, if we know him and follow his process, it is attainable. Jesus isn't sitting in heaven. Jesus didn't pray, may they be holy, and then go to heaven and hold his thumb. I hope they can find a way to be holy somehow. He said, no, I pray that they'll be holy, and I've made a way for them to be holy. It is available. It is on the table. Unity, truth, holiness, and mission have to work together in the church for the church to be Jesus' church. And they have to exist in you and I if they are to exist in the church. Like we cannot just talk about these four concepts as being out there, something that has to exist in the church. Before they can exist in everybody, they have to exist in somebody. Before they can exist in the church, they have to exist in me and in you. And as they exist in me and then you 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 and then you, so they begin to exist in the church. And when they exist in the church becomes beautiful. And when the church is beautiful, the world wants what she has. Which is why Jesus prayed, may sanctify her, set her apart in the truth, so that the world will know that you sent me. Friends, can you stand with me, please?